fantastic numbers our universe is based on.
And so we have this reach of mathematics in our universe, which is incredible. And you kind of wonder, how far can we push it? Is the universe mathematical? Is every, you know, sort of natural phenomena in our universe able to be described by mathematics? We don't know if that's true. It's been true up until now. It seems to work really well, but we don't know if it's universally true.
That's cosmologist Antonio Padilla. We talk with him about his book, Fantastic Numbers and Where to Find Them, A Cosmic Quest from Zero to Infinity. Then, from science to poetry, we replay our 2009 interview with the late U.S. Poet Laureate Richard Wilbur. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. And hey, do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to find extra content with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. I'm no math nerd, quite the opposite. But I've always been fascinated by the idea of math as a language, and a beautiful one at that. Even more fascinating is how the abstract language of math seems to describe the real world and the universe. But what if math doesn't just describe real phenomena, but actually underlies them? Is math not just a map, but the actual territory? As you'll hear in my conversation with theoretical physicist Antonio Padilla, we don't know the answer to that question yet. But his book, Fantastic Numbers and Where to Find Them, is a dazzling exploration of the strange numbers that illuminate the ultimate nature of reality. Numbers that are vanishingly small to unimaginably large, from zero to infinity. Padilla shows that the existence of the universe is highly improbable, but a teeny tiny number explains why it does in fact exist. In addition to showing how this and other fantastic numbers are the key to understanding things like black holes and relativity, Padilla's book entertains with charming portraits of some of the greatest mathematicians in history. It's a mind-bending journey into places most strange and wonderful. Antonio Padilla, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Hiya, lovely to be here.
Now, you are a cosmologist and a physicist and a mathematician, I would assume, as well. What drew you to these fields and the connections between them?
I think I've always loved maths in particular. As a child, I've always been drawn to numbers and the beauty of numbers. You know, I tell a story in my book about how my mum and dad, one Christmas, they gave us this dictionary. It's like one of these big, fat Collins English dictionaries. And I remember thinking at the time, well, why have they given me this dictionary? Because, you know, the only things I was really interested in at that point in time were football, or I guess as you guys call it, soccer, and maths. Like, those are my two big interests. And I didn't think I was going to find, well, I certainly didn't think I was going to find any football inside this dictionary. So then I decided, well, I'm going to look for some numbers in there. And I just started looking for all these big numbers, actually. I started looking up, you know, a billion and then a trillion. And then I saw a quadrillion. And I realized there's this pattern going on. And then, you know, I sort of ended up with a centillion. And that was kind of as far as I got with that particular exercise. But I think from there, you know, from those sort of early days, and then, you know, I went to university, I was drawn to did maths at university. But really what I found there was that I needed my numbers to sort of come to life in some way, to get some sort of personality. Whilst I still appreciated the beauty of mathematics, for me, the real personality of numbers came from trying to bring them into the physical world. And for that, I found that I needed physics and some wonderful physics. You know, you're talking about the physics of Einstein's theories of relativity, general relativity as well, the shape of space and time, quantum mechanics, this mysterious world of sort of probability and uncertainty, all these wonderful things. But for me, it was trying to bring numbers into the physical realm, to bring them to life, to give them personality, that really excited me. And that's what drew me to sort of become a physicist and to think about these questions of numbers within our universe. And that drew me to cosmology. And it's really what my book is about.
You know, I've always wondered, and I have to confess, I'm actually so inept at numbers that I think I have a math disability. But I've always wondered why does math allow us to understand physics, even physics that we can't yet test? I mean, what is the connection between this thing that people made up and the actual physical universe?
That is absolutely amazing question. And I don't think there's a definite answer. I mean, so one thing that we know to be true is that this man-made construct of ours, this mathematics that we have made up, as human beings, does a really amazing job of describing the natural world. Now, you could argue it had no right to do that. And we see it in such disparate parts, right? You know, you look at Newton's laws of gravity. They describe a football bouncing along in a field. They also describe planets going around the sun. I mean, or stars going around the center of a galaxy. So you're talking really disparate things here. And yet the mathematics that we've introduced can describe them. There's a lovely article from, like, I think it's from around 1960 by a Nobel laureate called Wigner, who's a physicist, and he actually wrote this essay about the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics in nature, and he has some really interesting ideas in there. He starts the story off with a little joke of a statistician who's looking at population trends. And he's showing this some of the the statistics associated with it, and in some of the equations that he has, there's the number pi, 3.14, the symbol pi, this Greek symbol. And somebody goes, well, what's that symbol there? And he says, oh, that's pi. And he's like, well, what's that? Well, he goes, that's something that relates the radius of a circle to its circumference. And so his friend goes, well, what's that got to do with population trends? And the truth is, it doesn't look like it has anything to do. And yet this number pi appears in both the mathematics of population trends and the mathematics of circles. And so we have this reach of mathematics in our universe, which is incredible. And you kind of wonder, how far can we push it? Is the universe mathematical? Is every sort of natural phenomena in our universe able to be described by mathematics? We don't know if that's true. It's been true up until now. It seems to work really well, but we don't know if it's universally true. And even if it is true, you then face the question of, well, okay, maybe everything in the universe can be described by maths, but actually it could be that there's maths which is not in the universe. That's entirely possible, right? So it could be that everything in the universe is described by maths, but there's more maths than what is in the universe. And then that begs the question, what picked that corner of the mathematical world? You know, for example, to give an example of that, of what I'm talking about, maybe everything in the universe is finite, in which case you would only need finite mathematics, but there's transfinite mathematics as well. And so why did we pick one and not the other? So there's loads of mystery. You could go so far in trying to ask that question that you asked and wonder about the possibilities, but I don't have an answer because, I mean, we don't know the answer.
I also wanted to ask you, because it seems to me in some ways this is a deeply philosophical book, and maybe even a spiritual book. I mean, it involves mysteries. It involves unprovable things that yet can be described somehow by mathematics. And you write, just right in the beginning, you say, it worries me to think that everything I know should never have existed. Me, my family, my closest friends, this book should never have existed. And yet somehow you're reading it right now in a moment that might never have arrived. I mean, that's a beautiful thing to say. Why? Why should these things never have existed? What do you mean by that?
So that point I was making there was really sort of, it's because our universe is so unexpected. You know, you might think that everything you see around us is fairly routine and very ordinary, but actually the universe we live in is really, really unexpected. And what kind of universe should have we been living in? And the answer to that is one that should have crushed itself out of existence before you were born, before any of us were born. And the reason for that is that one of the things that we can ask about the universe is how much it weighs, right? Literally, what is the weight of the universe? Now, you might say, well, the weight of the universe comes from the weight of all the people in it, the weight of all the aliens, the weight of all the planets and stars and so on. Add all that up and you get like the mass of the universe, if you like. But what if you took all that stuff out? You took all the planets out. You took all the stars out. You took all the people out. What weight, what mass is left over? And you might think there's nothing left over, but that's not true. What there is empty space, and empty space actually weighs. This is something that we learned from quantum mechanics, that empty space isn't really a boring, uninteresting thing. It's actually something that is really quite exciting. What happens in empty space is you have sort of what are called virtual particles, literally popping in and out of existence just for an instant. And this sort of broth of activity that we expect from quantum theory, this broth of particles popping in and out of existence that happens in empty space, that actually makes empty space weigh. It gives it energy, it gives it mass, it weighs it down. And we can calculate how much weight we think the universe will get from this seething broth of empty space. And our calculations show that it should be a whole lot of mass and energy from this seething broth. In fact, so much that the effects of gravity would react to that energy and bend the universe into oblivion, because that's what general relativity, Einstein's theory of gravity, tells us, that when you have energy, when you have mass, it bends space and time. So we're saying empty space has this seething broth of activity, which is weighing down the universe, which is giving it mass and energy. And that's going to bend space and time. And actually, there's so much massive energy in that seething broth that it should have bent it into oblivion. But it didn't. And that is the big mystery. That is one of the biggest mysteries in fundamental physics.
And is there a number associated with that?
There is a number associated with that. So the number associated with it is kind of like, it's 10 to the minus 120. So that's 0 point, and then you have 119 zeros, and then a one. And the reason that that's the number associated with it, that's kind of a measure of, it's a ratio of two things, right? On the one hand, you've got how much that empty space actually weighs. How much does it actually weigh? Not how much we think it should weigh based on our best ideas, but how much it actually weighs from the measurements. Well, we know the universe didn't crush itself into oblivion. It survived for a long time. So the actual weight of the universe isn't that much. It's not that much. It's quite low. So you take that number, how much does it actually weigh? And you compare it to the number we expect, the number that our calculations are pointing towards. And the fraction is, the ratio of those two numbers is a really, really, really tiny number. This is 10 to the minus 120. And you shouldn't really get tiny. If you're getting tiny, this huge sort of mismatch between these two numbers, that's what that small number represents. And small numbers, whenever you encounter them in physics, they're telling you something unexpected is happening. And this is the most unexpected thing in the universe. Why is empty space so free of energy, really? Why is there so little energy in there, so little mass, when our calculations coming from quantum mechanics and quantum theory tells us there should be loads? The ratio of those two numbers that are sort of related to that is 10 to the minus 120, a tiny number, and tiny numbers tell us that something unexpected is going on. And that's where we look to learn more about the fundamental fabric of the physical universe. That's where we can find new physics to try to explain it, hopefully, anyway.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with theoretical physicist Antonio Padilla about his book, Fantastic Numbers and Where to Find Them. It's a cosmic tour of 9 of the most extraordinary numbers in physics, offering a startling picture of how the universe works. So I'm going to take a wild stab here. That tiny, tiny, tiny number that differential is why the universe is actually expanding and not collapsing in on itself?
It's really why the universe is so big, right? Why did it get big? The universe is huge, right? We can all agree that it's a really big place and it's nice and big and we can live in it. But had the number been the number our calculations suggest, it would have never got the chance to be big. It would have literally torn back on itself, but it didn't. It was allowed to grow big. So yeah, it is in a way related to the expansion, but it's how much it was allowed to expand. It was allowed to expand a lot and get really, really big compared to not really being allowed to expand very much at all. So that's that mystery of why that happened is what's sort of encoded in that little number.
Now, there's so many places to go with this. I think I'm going to go back to actually an even smaller number, which is zero. This is a number that was feared. It was even seen as evil. Why? And why do you say it's the most beautiful number there is?
So the reason it was seen as evil, this goes back to sort of medieval times, really, is that it was, well, actually, you can go back even further to sort of the Greeks. But it was associated with the void, you know, with emptiness, with nothingness, with empty space, with nothing. And when the sort of ancient thinkers thought about this, they would identify that with not just the absence of a sort of everyday stuff, you know, like, I don't know, a bag of corn or, you know, a jar of oil or something. They would identify it with the absence of God. And so, of course, in the eyes of a medieval thinker, the absence of God was something that was fundamentally evil and fundamentally should be mistrusted. So that's why that was really at the core of why the, you know, the medieval thinkers, you know, there was a lot of resistance to this zero. Why do I say it's the opposite of evil? It's actually beautiful. Well, for me, what zero represents is symmetry. And what do I mean by that? Well, symmetry is zero is the only number that has the following property. And that's that when you flip its sign, you get back the same number. So for example, if I take the number five, if I flip the sign of the number five, I get minus five, right? Well, minus five is not the same as five. Minus three is not the same as three. But minus zero is the same as zero. And zero is the only number with that property. And that's what we call a symmetry, when you can sort of operate, you know, do something to something and get back the same thing. You get something that looks the same. And symmetry in nature is what underpins all of physics. It's been the driving force of fundamental physics in the 20th century, especially. You know, this idea that as you zoom in on the sort of fabric of physics and our universe, as you look more closely at sort of microscopic structure, you might think things get more complicated, but actually they don't. You start to see more symmetry emerge. And you actually start to see zeros emerge as you zoom in on the sort of microstructure of our universe. And it's really beautiful. It's really elegant. It actually makes the equations that govern it simpler, not more complicated.
Well, that's so interesting because humans have a tropism to see symmetry as beautiful.
Absolutely. That's absolutely true. I think that there is this, this I think it's called the evolutionary advantage theory, where, you know, you sort of look at a human face, we as humans find symmetry attractive in a human face. And there's reasons for why they believe this to be the case. And it's because, you know, sort of a lack of symmetry, you know, it might, for example, it might cause be a reflection of some sort of disease or something, you know, if you've got some sort of growths on one side and things like that. So you know, and of course, if something's diseased or something like that, then it's not good for sort of procreation. And so as species, we, you know, there's this claim that we find symmetry attractive. So yeah, it's true in our everyday lives that there's this beauty, but it's very much true in the microstructure of the physical world.
Now, talking about symmetry, this is probably a different kind of thing, but it's at least associated in my mind. We'll go to some very big numbers, Googles and Googleplexes. You relate them to something called cosmic doppelgangers. I mean, this was just mind-blowing. Talk about this and say what a doppelganger is, too.
Yeah, so well, first I should probably say what a Google and a Googleplex is. So a Google is a big number, right? It's a one followed by 100 zeros. So I think we can all agree that's a big number. It goes back to a physicist called Edward Kasner, who was writing a book about sort of infinity, actually. And he wanted to demonstrate that this number, which was obviously big, as you know, in everybody's eyes, is actually tiny compared to the infinite. And the name of Google arose because he actually consulted his 9-year-old nephew, who's called Milton, for a name. He said, "What should I call this number?" And Milton came up with a Google, which is a great name. And then, but Kasner wanted to go further. He wanted an even bigger number to play with. So he says, "Well, I'm going to come up with a Googleplex." So he said to his nephew, "Well, what should a Googleplex be? It needs to be bigger than a Google. Now remember, a Google is already a one with 100 zeros." And well, he said, "Well, okay, maybe a Googleplex can be sort of a one followed by zeros until you get tired." And right, so I mean, Kasner, being a physicist or mathematician, that was way too imprecise. So he wasn't happy with that. So he went for a more precise definition, which was that a Googleplex should be a one followed by a Google zeros. So remember, a Google's a one followed by 100 zeros. A Googleplex is a one followed by a Google zero. So this is truly gargantuan number. Now, what I wanted to do, which again, this goes back to sort of what I said earlier about how I really wanted to, as I started to learn more and more mathematics, I learned that I wanted to bring mathematics to life by bringing it into the physical world. I wanted to give these numbers personality. And when I was first thinking about Googleplex and I was making a YouTube video about it, that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to sort of drag it into the physical world. How can I bring a Googleplex into the physical world? And one of the things I thought about was, well, okay, what if the universe was a Googleplex meters across? Now, that may be true. We don't know. It may be true. It may not be true. But I want to ask, well, what if it is true? What if the universe is a Googleplex meters across? So literally, I could go from where I'm stood now and carry on a Googleplex meters, and the universe would still not end. Now, the thing is, when you start to think about a universe that's truly that large, then you realize that the idea of doppelgangers becomes real. And what a doppelganger is, it's an exact copy. So this is what a doppelganger means. It's an exact copy. But I don't just mean an exact copy of, you know, of me or you, somebody who just looks like me. I don't just mean something that just looks like me. I'm talking about literally an exact copy. So it looks exactly like me. It's got the same thoughts. All its atoms are arranged in the same place. I would even go so far as to say that the quantum state that describes it is identical. So it literally is an exact copy in by any kind of definition that you can imagine. So, I mean, that's what I mean by a doppelganger in this context. And what I call a Googleplexian universe, in a universe that's a Googleplex meters across, then all of us will have doppelgangers. All of us will have these exact copies of ourselves, and they will be out there, and there will be many of them. I will have a doppelganger. You will have a doppelganger. I don't know. Joe Biden will have a doppelganger. Everybody will have one, right? They're all out there. But the universe has to be big enough to accommodate them. And that's where the Googleplex comes in.
So why? I mean, is there an easy or simple way to explain why there must be in a universe big enough to have doppelgangers of all of us?
Yeah, so sort of a simple way to describe it is, at least to get the right idea, is to say, well, let's take me, right, and ask, well, how much space do I occupy? Well, I occupy roughly a cubic meter of space, more or less. It depends how much I've been eating lately or something, right? But it's roughly a cubic meter of space. Well, I can look at a cubic meter of space and I can ask, how many different ways can I arrange the atoms and, well, maybe more precisely, the building, you know, the physical building blocks of nature. How many different ways can I arrange them in any given cubic meter of space? Well, one arrangement is me, is the arrangement that is me, right? Another arrangement is you, Francesca, right? Another arrangement is Joe Biden. Another arrangement is empty space. Another arrangement is a cow. Another arrangement is an alien. There's many, many different arrangements that you can do with a cubic meter of space, right? So, but there's not an infinite number. One of the things we know, if this comes from deep ideas about gravity that I won't go into, but these ideas tell us that there's actually a finite number. There's only a finite number of ways to arrange a cubic meter of space. And that finite number is actually less than a Googleplex. So now we can do a little experiment. We can say, okay, we look at the cubic meter of space that I occupy, and that's with all the atoms and everything arranged in one particular way. And then I look at the next cubic meter of space, and it's arranged differently. And then I look at the next cubic meter of space, and that's arranged differently again. And I keep going. And because the total number of arrangements is less than a Googolplex, eventually it's inevitable I will see repetitions. And actually, the difference between the number of arrangements and a Googolplex is actually so big, even the unlikely arrangements will start to be repeated. And it's inevitable you'll start seeing doppelgangers of me, you, and everybody else.
Well, that's fascinating. And is there a way in which that notion has been used practically, let's say, in our world?
I'm not so sure that's true. I mean, you know, sort of, that's a very good question.
Well, all right, let me follow that up then, because what that puts me in mind in of is something that isn't precisely a doppelganger, but close enough, multiverses. You know, I used to love science fiction, and I used to especially love the books that talked about multiverses with different versions of our universe, just slightly different, with different outcomes. And I just, could you talk a little bit about that and explain that and its connection to numbers in your book?
So there's many different ways. When people talk about multiverses, there's different ways in which different things that they mean. One of the things you probably heard of, this is probably one that sort of, you know, reaches out into popular media the most, is the idea that you know, you get multiverses from quantum mechanics, from the uncertainty in quantum mechanics. And the way people describe it is you toss a coin and there's a 50-50 chance that it'll be heads, a 50-50 chance it'll be tails. And the outcome of that coin toss splits the universe and you end up with two universes, one where it's heads and one where it's tails. And that this kind of uncertainty occurs on a quantum level. And each time you have one outcome or another, the universe splits. Now, that's not an interpretation of quantum mechanics that I particularly aspire to. I don't think there's much truth in that. I don't think we need it to sort of understand quantum theory in the way that others say we do. I think perhaps at an underlying level, there is just uncertainty in the universe. There is just probability. There is quantum mechanics. There are sort of microscopic coin tosses going on all the time. And that's fine. You don't have to split a universe to describe it. So that's one type of multiverse, which I don't necessarily ascribe to too much. There's another type of multiverse that people talk about, and that's in the context, and I talk about this in my book, and that's in the context of string theory. So string theory is probably our best theory of a quantum theory of gravity. So that's a theory of gravity, so literally of space and time, but on a microscopic scale, so where you have really, really small distances where the gravitational forces are really, really strong. It's a theory of gravity that you would hope to describe the center of a black hole or the beginning of the universe. It's, you know, it's a really exotic idea. So that's string theory. But string theory, one of the things it predicts is that there isn't just one possible universe. The theory predicts that there are actually many possible universes, in fact, way more than a Google. There's a huge number. Some people, the number varies depending on how you think about it, but 10 to the 500, you know, it's a one with 500 zeros. There's some bigger numbers, I think, you know, 10 to the 1,000 and so on. There's various estimates that you can look at. And so string theory predicts that all these possible universes, this all comes from the fact that in string theory, there aren't four dimensions of space and time, you know, three dimensions of space and one dimension of time. There are actually many more. And so one of the things you have to do is you have to hide away those extra dimensions. And there's many different ways you can hide them away. And all the different ways yield a different universe that you could possibly live in. And that's the multiverse of string theory. And it's possible that you can jump from one universe to another. You know, you can do these little quantum jumps that hop you around this multiverse. And we find ourselves in one universe, but in the past, you know, this pocket of space might have been in a different multiverse where the laws of nature might be very different. It might not even be a four-dimensional universe. It might be a higher dimensional universe. Gravity might be stronger or it could be weaker. The electromagnetic forces could be stronger or weaker. It could have a different particle content. It could be very different. And that's the idea of a multiverse, which I think is much more compelling because it comes from sort of our most important theory of quantum gravity that we have available.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with theoretical physicist Antonio Padilla about his book, Fantastic Numbers and Where to Find Them. So this is a real thing that could be, not just a way of describing a mathematical concept. There could be actual, real, physical universes that we can't, I mean, I don't even see how we could jump to them if they had different laws, or would we even know we were in a different one?
So that what you would have is a scenario where you'd have bubbles of different universes. So we could literally exist in a bubble. And outside of this bubble is a different type of universe where the laws of nature are subtly different. You know, as I said, gravity might be stronger or weaker. There might be different particles. But there could be bubbles of different universe within our universe where, smaller bubbles. And there's a whole sort of percolation effect where you have these bubbles of different universe sort of, popping in and around each other. So, yeah, I mean, those could exist. If string theory is the right theory, and our understanding of it that we have at the moment is correct, then yes, I would say these things are real. And actually, people are looking for evidence of these bubbles in observations. One of the things we look at what's called the cosmic microwave background radiation. What this is radiation that's out there that's left over from the Big Bang. If you haven't had an old analog TV, you see little bits of it, when you have those dodgy signals, there's little bits of cosmic microwave background radiation in that sort of crackly signal. So we look at that radiation, we can unpick the details. And one thing we can look for is evidence that there are bubbles out there, big, large bubbles in the universe. And so we are looking for that. Now, there's been no sign of them yet, but that would be, if we did find that, that would be a real sort of smoking gun for these idea of a multiverse, I would say.
And we do know that, I'm not sure it's a general theory of relativity or the special one, but we know that Einstein posited it decades before it was actually proven. So this is something that could also be proven. And finally, I wanted to ask you then, you make a very big claim about these numbers. First of all, you talk about something called the holographic truth, and you say it leads to a theory of everything. So I wonder if you could wrap us up in this theory of everything in the holographic truth.
So the holographic truth, I think, is arguably the most remarkable idea to have come out of fundamental physics, I think, in the last possibly 50 years, really. It's an incredible sort of insight into maybe how the fabric of nature is. And it comes from thinking about black holes and the physics of black holes. They're regimes where gravity is at the extreme. So they really give you a window into thinking about physics in a way you wouldn't ordinarily think about. And what that's led us to believe is that nature is holographic. So what do I mean by that? I mean that in some sense, nature is holographic, that you normally talk about three dimensions of space, right? And our universe, we look around as it certainly seems three-dimensional, and we can be confident that there is a gravitational force in that universe because you can drop something, an apple can fall on your head, and you can be confident that gravity seems to be there. So we have a three-dimensional world with gravity. And what the holographic truth asserts is that one of those dimensions and the gravitational force are in a sense an illusion. And this is incredible. And as I said, this comes from thinking deeply about black holes. And the illusion is that actually the reality is that you can think about exactly the same physical phenomena that you see in this three-dimensional world with its gravitational force, all the physical phenomena that you can describe in that universe, actually, you can describe them just as well with a different mathematics. And it's a mathematics that exists in a two-dimensional world and has no gravity. So when I throw a football across a field or I jump up and down or a planet goes around the sun, right? I don't need to describe that with the mathematics of three dimensions and gravity. I can describe it with another mathematics, which only has two dimensions and has no gravity. And so this is in a sense, it's holographic in that, you think about what is a hologram. Well, a hologram encodes information in one of two ways. You can encode the information on a holographic plate, which is two-dimensional, right? And it has some bands of various sort of, you know, density on this holographic plate, and it that encodes some information. It's not particularly easily decoded information, but it's information nevertheless. Now, what you can do is you can shine monochromatic light through this holographic plate, and you can get a three-dimensional image emerge, right? And it's still, it's just the same information, but decoded in a different way. And that's kind of what our universe is like. They're saying there's two ways to think about it. You can think about it as three dimensions with gravity, or you can think about it as just two dimensions and no gravity. For some reason, our brains seem to decode it in the former sense. But actually, mathematically, we can describe it in the latter sense as well. And, you know, it's a conjecture at the moment, but it's a conjecture which there is, you know, some compelling evidence. Whether our universe is truly holographic remains to be seen, but certainly it does point to something really deep about the fundamental nature of gravity in particular.
And the theory of everything?
Well, in some sense, the theory of everything is the theory of all nature, of the gravitational force bonded together with the other forces of, you know, like nuclear forces and electromagnetic forces. And so the theory of everything is the theory of all things. And in particular, not only do you have to push the electromagnetic force and the nuclear forces to the extreme, you also have to push gravity to the extreme if you want a true theory of everything. And what we're learning is if you push gravity to the extreme, this holographic reality seems to emerge. So yeah, whether the ultimate fundamental theory of everything will have this holographic property, I think it's likely. All the evidence seems to be pointing that it will. Of course, it's still a conjecture at the moment, and I guess time will tell.
Wow. Well, it is really an amazing book, Fantastic Numbers and Where to Find Them, A Cosmic Quest from Zero to Infinity. We didn't even talk about infinity. There is so much more in this book than we covered. It's just been mind-blowing and delightful to talk with you about it, Antonio Padilla.
Thank you so much. It's lovely talking to you.
Antonio Padilla teaches physics at the University of Nottingham in the UK, and spreads popular awareness about math and physics on YouTube. Go to writersvoice.net to watch his video about a really, really, really big number. Next up, a listen back to my 2009 conversation with poet Richard Wilbur. Stay tuned after the break.
Zero. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 10, 10, 10, 10 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20 100, 1,000, 10,000, 100,000, 1,000,000, 1,000,000, 10,000,000, 100,000,000, 1,000,000,000.
That was clips from the Big Numbers song from Kids TV 123. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. When a guest for this week canceled his appearance, I thought I would dip into my barrel of favorite episodes. What came up was the following conversation with former poet laureate, the late Richard Wilbur. Wilbur passed away in 2017, but in 2009, I visited him along with writer Christian McEwen for a lovely hour listening to him read and talk about his poetry. Here's an excerpt from our conversation. Richard Wilbur is one of America's greatest living poets. He earned the Pulitzer Prize for poetry twice, once in 1957 and then in 1989. That gives you an idea of the long span of his life as a poet. He actually published his first poem at the age of 8, and he's been a regular contributor of poetry to The New Yorker for many years. Wilbur's poems are honed to a deceptive simplicity. As one reviewer said, all of them are easy to read while being suffused with an astonishing verbal music and a compacted thoughtfulness that invites sustained reflection. Wilbur's work is informed by a celebratory timbre of the world and of the individuals within it. The poet Randall Jarrell said that he was always reminded of Petronius's phrase, studied felicity, whenever he read a book of Wilbur's. But before we get to our interview with Wilbur, I'd like to play an excerpt from an interview I did with Jean Bram in 2007 about her book Light Within the Light. In it, she writes about four New England poets, one of whom is Richard Wilbur. She titles a chapter about him, A Difficult Balance. I asked her why.
I think it was by the time Richard Wilbur was 32 that he had won all of the major prizes save the Pulitzer. I don't think he won that till he was 35. He just had an extraordinary meteoric rise to the heights most people work for by the time they're 70 in poetry. And then he had the misfortune to fall out of fashion. The mid-1970s through about the mid-1980s, I think, saw the rise of the confessional school of poetry. And as a matter of fact, Anne Sexton was one of the major movers and shakers in that highly subjective, well, it is just what it says, I will confess the pain of my life and I will spill it on the page. And of course, Wilbur's work has always been going in just the opposite direction, which is not to say there isn't pain in the work, but it is beautifully balanced with what there is in life to affirm. And it is suspended in a wonderfully symmetrical, intricate, stanzaic forms. So for about a 10-year period, his verse really fell out of favor. And when literary critics would talk about the Redskins in American literature and the Pale Faces, invariably he was a pale face.
Or when they'd what do you mean by that? Redskins and pale faces?
Well, they meant the gutsy, spermy, blood on the page school of poetry as opposed to the Apollonian, balanced, affirming kind of poetry and poet that Wilbur has always represented.
Writer Jean Bram. We at Writer's Voice are lucky that Wilbur lives so close to where we produce the show. It's a pleasant country drive out to his home in the foothills of the Berkshires and the small rural town of Cummington, Massachusetts. Guest co-host Christian McEwen and I drove out there in June. Richard Wilbur, I want to just thank you so much for inviting us into your lovely writing domain. You know, when I first called you up and asked you if you would consent to talk with me and now us about your poems, I got the distinct sense that you really wanted to talk about your latest poems, the ones that have been published in The New Yorker over the last few years. So I think I'd like to just dive in with the latest and ask you, do you see, first of all, some changes, some differences in your latest poetry from some of your earlier work?
I can't say whether there's any difference of a stylistic nature. Probably the process of becoming opener and opener, which happened in my many years of writing poems, has gone on. And one of my recent subjects, anybody can tell, is the loss of my beloved wife, who was a great encourager of my poetry, and to whom I address quite a few words of verse still. Another thing that's happened in recent years, I don't know exactly how to explain this, is that I've taken to writing in haiku stanzas, rhyming the first and third line of each stanza. It turns out to be a very agreeable way to talk for my present inclinations.
You said that over the years of being a poet that you have become more and more open. I wonder if you could tell us more about what do you mean? What is the process of becoming more open as a poet? What does that mean?
Well, I think I can put it pretty plainly. When I began to concern myself a lot with poetry, and perhaps to write my earliest efforts, I think that I was strongly impressed by the new critics of the early part of the 20th century, and therefore felt that a poem ought to be a full account of one's consciousness in the most self-contradictory way possible. My poems were full of ironies and other modes of differing from myself. And they were as psychologically complex as I could make them be. And then I found myself from 1950 onward getting mixed up in the translation of plays for the theater. And if you do that fortunately and wholeheartedly, as I did, you find that there's some transference from the translation of drama to the technique of one's own poems. I found that my poems came to be more and more straightforward utterances of some one mood of mine. One of my various selves was given its head. And I do think that that has pretty well gone on. Irony and self-contradiction have not vanished from my poetry, but it's not as conspicuous, I think, as it was in my early efforts.
So basically what you're talking about then is a kind of progressive simplification, that openness and simplicity, not in a way of saying that things are less profound by any means, but in that stripping away of complexity as one gains in one's craft. Is that right?
Well, I think I'm saying that I've simply become more dramatic, and that I give some aspect of my experience its head more than I was inclined to do in my early days. I don't know how true an account this is of the development of my writing, but that's the way I feel it.
And could you give an example of one of your latest... Do you have some of your latest poems here? Can you read some of them?
Yes.
Because that would be wonderful, yeah.
Well, here's a fairly recent poem of mine that came out in the New Yorker. And it's like a lot of my poems in the past, in the sense that I always try to get the nature right. I remember an amusing attack on various poets like Dylan Thomas by Jeffrey Grigson, in which he pointed out to them that there is no such thing as a grave worm, and that if you're going to write about natural things, you ought to look them up in a book or know them as a countryman knows things. Well, this is the nature in this is to be trusted, whatever else. It's called A Measuring Worm. This yellow-striped green caterpillar climbing up the steep window screen constantly, for lack of a full set of legs, keeps humping up his back. It's as if he's sent by a sort of semaphore, dark omegas meant to warn of last things. Although he doesn't know it, he will soon have wings. And I too don't know toward what undreamt condition, inch by inch, I go. Well, that's the sort of poem you write when you're getting to be 88 years old, and there's more than a little sense of mortality in this poem, though it's taken lightly.
Yes, and that note of lightness as well as, I mean, it is a kind of a chiaroscuro there in a way, because there's the lightness of the little, the inchworm and the measuring worm, as well as that sense of mortality. Christian and I were talking before we came up here about your use of nature in the poetry, and I'd like to turn the mic over to her because we had some reflections on how that is incorporated in your work.
I wanted to ask you, because I heard recently that the Oxford Junior Dictionary was dropping a whole crowd of nature-related words from its children's edition. I don't know if you knew this.
No, I haven't.
It was very shocking to me. They were taking away words like wren and heron, and even very children's words like goldfish and gerbil and hamster, and they were replacing them with computer words like chat room and BlackBerry in the new sense and blog. And there was actually been a protest about it. And when I was I just had heard this when I was reading your poems preparatory to coming here, and I remembered an old came across an old poem of yours called Advice to a Prophet,
yeah,
in which you say, "What should we be without the dolphin's ark, the dove's return, these things in which we have seen ourselves and spoken?" So I was wondering what you would make of this fact, of this powerful, I mean, the Oxford edition of things for the children is important, and they're taking away and trashing essentially all these very important nature-related words.
Well, I'm appalled to hear that. It seems to me that every child should see a heron and know what he or she is looking at. I was brought up on somebody else's farm with a lot of country and a lot of animals and a lot of trees, the names of which I knew, and it seemed to me a happy and normal childhood. And I'm distressed that these lexicographers have a notion that children can grow up without a continual knowing contact with the environment. It's a shocking notion. Now that I think of it, a physical therapist whom I know was saying to me the other day that her children spend very much less time out of doors than she and her contemporaries used to do, that it's hard to get them away from their dreadful little machines.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with poet Richard Wilbur about some of his new poems and also his life as a poet. I asked Richard Wilbur to read the poem Advice to a Prophet. I'd found it in my collection of 100 Greatest Poems of the 20th Century, edited by fellow poet laureate Mark Strand.
And right over there, that picture of the night sky was sent me by Mark Strand, so I'm on good terms with him. Well, this poem, Advice to a Prophet, which you kindly request, was written after a long period of trying to be adequate to the subject of the nuclear threat. When I read this to an audience, I often remember that I was on leave from the ETO in England when we dropped the bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And a fellow soldier said to me, I'll give you $10 if you can write a poem about that by the weekend. And I told him to keep his money. It took me until 1959 finally to measure up to what, after all, is a big fact in our lives and has to be written about. Well, I'll read it with no further ado. Advice to a Prophet. When you come, as you soon must, to the streets of our city, mad-eyed from stating the obvious, not proclaiming our fall, but begging us in God's name to have self-pity, spare us all word of the weapons, their force and range, the long numbers that rocket the mind. Our slow, unreckoning hearts will be left behind, unable to fear what is too strange. Nor shall you scare us with talk of the death of the race. How should we dream of this place without us? The sun, mere fire, the leaves untroubled about us, a stone look on the stone's face. Speak of the world's own change. Though we cannot conceive of an undreamt thing, we know to our cost how the dreamt cloud crumbles, the vines are blackened by frost, how the view alters. We could believe, if you told us so, that the white-tailed deer will slip into perfect shade, grown perfectly shy. The lark avoid the reaches of our eye. The jackpine lose its knuckled grip on the cold ledge. And every torrent burn as Xanthus once, its gliding trout stunned in a twinkling. What should we be without the dolphin's ark, the dove's return, these things in which we have seen ourselves and spoken? Ask us, prophet, how we shall call our natures forth when that lie of tongue is all dispelled, that glass obscured or broken, in which we have said the rose of our love and the clean horse of our courage, in which beheld the singing locust of the soul unshelled, and all we mean or wish to mean. Ask us whether with the wordless rose our hearts shall fail us. Come demanding whether there shall be lofty or long standing when the bronze annals of the oak tree close.
You read that, it's an elegy, really, in the tone and the sense of the poem. And I think, you know, we haven't really progressed much since those days. Maybe we think less of the nuclear holocaust and we think more of the planet dying through climate change. But so much of your poetry is really infused with a great sense of joy. And you have said, you have in the Paris Review interviews, you said that the ultimate character of things is comely and good. How do you put this together with your enduring optimism, it seems, that comes in your poetry, the celebration that's in your poetry? Maybe optimism is not the right word.
Well, the world does seem to me wondrously made, or perhaps I should just say wondrous, and I've never ceased to respond to it, its beauty and fascination, whatever else there may be to bewail. And another thing about positiveness in poetry, I do think, in my case, it's simply constitutional. I am inclined, as my friend Randall Jarrell said, to see the bright underside of every dark thing.
You've just gone through a great loss.
Yes.
And I was reading your biography and talking with Christian on the way up here. I was saying, wow, it just seems like Richard Wilbur has lived a very charmed life. Of course, that's looking at it from the outside. But you were together with your wife since you were kids, basically.
Well, yes. She was, I guess, a sophomore at Smith when I met her. And we were together as man and wife for 64 years. And I feel very lucky about that, which is not to say that I cheerfully accept her absence. But in that respect, I've certainly had a very fortunate life. And I've had a fortunate life in finding what it was that I could do fairly well and what it was that could prove in one way or another useful to other people. All that's good. I could give you a list of dreadful things that have happened to me or to those I love. But on the whole, I vote yes.
I wonder if poetry has been a consolation for you. Also, you say you still write poems to your wife. Is that how I understood what you said?
Well, my wife was, from the very beginning, the great encourager of my poems, and she was the person to whom I showed them always. And the many translations I've done from 17th century French drama, I always checked with her first and checked with her line by line. Her French was better than mine anyway. And I still feel encouraged by her. And I feel as if I feel something like her approval as I sit down and try to write yet another poem. And thank heavens, the words do keep coming. I find, like anyone of 88 years old, that there are various words which elude me, especially names are getting away from me. But I still find enough of them, if I'm patient, to put some poems together.
Well, you mentioned your translations, and that's something else I wanted to ask you about. How do you approach translation? You've translated Molière and Racine, the plays of them, but also an awful lot of poetry from the French as well as others. And so talk a bit about what you struggle with in doing translation, how you find that voice, and what is your approach towards the voice?
Well, I think that the job of the translator, if he's just not fooling around, is to be utterly slavish, to manage to find an equivalent for all of the words that are in the original, at any rate all of the thoughts, and for the form of the original, and then above all for the tone of the original. I think that's where translations which are linguistically worthy often go wrong. And one reason I've translated just about everything of Molière's that was done in verse is that I came to feel that I was being true to him, that I was in tune with his sense of what was funny and also his sense of what people and the world generally were like. So for me, it's been a long exercise in fidelity, and I hope I haven't kidded myself.
We're talking today with Richard Wilbur, one of America's greatest living poets. I'm joined by co-host Christian McEwen on this interview.
I'm good friends with the translator and poet Alistair Reid. I've known him since I was a child, and I'm imagining you know his Neruda translations and so forth. I was wondering how translation has influenced your own poetry making and the conversation back and forth between translation and poetry.
I think translation has had an enormous effect on my own poetry. And reverting to something I was saying a few moments ago, the act of translation, especially as I was translating on the whole plays, has led me in the direction of being more dramatic, more open. I think that's been the chief effect of it.
I'd like to ask you something now about the form and the way you do poetry. I mean, you've gone against the tide of lots of late 20th century poetry, which was done in free verse. Mm-hmm. Yours has been more formal, and it rhymes. And, well, you knew Frost. You knew Robert Frost. And some have actually compared your work
Yes.
to Robert Frost. You've quoted him. He said, "Bad poets rhyme words, good poets rhyme phrases." Could you talk more about how the formal structure of the poetry, and you're recently now doing haiku, how does that structure be the container for your poetry?
I think of form as something which is not the final end of any poem, even if one is writing in one of those tricky old forms that the poets of the latter 19th century were fond of. It seems to me that that the use of form is a way simply of augmenting the emphases of what one is saying. Rhymes are there for one reason, because rhyming words are or should be important words. They should be words which can be heard with a special emphasis because of the chiming of sounds. And what I always tell students when they ask me about meter is that the use of any meter or of any form like the sonnet form is to be violated in a meaningful way. The great users of our basic meter, the iambic pentameter, people like Milton, just tear the hell out of the line. They're not being tidy about it. And the most boring poems are poems which, for no reason at all, are metronomic. So for me, meter and rhyme and traditional forms are all means to saying what one wants to say with more power and definition.
One poem that illustrates Wilbur's use of form to empower its meaning is Trismegistus. I asked him to read it to us.
Yes, that's one of my most recent poems. And I think I've had a lot of reaction to that, more than usual. And partly I think it's because it is one of my best poems, also because it's on a challenging topic and approaches it from an odd angle.
And for those of our listeners who don't know to whom it refers, tell us who Hermes Trismegistus was.
Well, Hermes Trismegistus is someone, perhaps he never existed. Chances are he never existed, and I shan't go into all the lies which were told about him. But he was an important name in the Hermetic movement of the early Christian era. And our best sense of Hermes Trismegistus comes from Milton's Il Penseroso, where he refers to Hermes and indeed describes himself as summoning up the spirit of this ancient figure of Hermetic lore to contribute to his ponderings.
And as I remember also, he was said to have been a melding of the god Hermes and the Egyptian god Thoth, and that he wrote some 35,000 books.
Well, yes, or somebody wrote a lot of things and attributed them to this man who did or did not exist. But there are certain central ideas associated with Hermes, which Milton invokes in his Il Penseroso. Well, shall I read this poem?
Please do.
It begins with a quotation from the great lament of Hermes, and I'm indebted for these words to Francis Yates, who quoted them first. O Egypt, Egypt, so the great lament of thrice great Hermes went. Nothing of thy religion shall remain save fables which thy children shall disdain. His grieving eye foresaw the world's bright fabric overthrown, which married star to stone and charged all things with awe. And what in that dismantled world could be more fabulous than he? Had he existed, was he but a name tacked on to forgeries which pressed the claim of every ancient quack, that one could from a smoky cell by talisman or spell coerce the zodiac? Still, Still, we summon him at midnight hour to Milton's pensive tower, and hear him tell again how then and now creation is a house of mirrors, how each herb that sips the dew dazzles the eye with many small reflections of the all, which, after all, is true.
I think that's a marvelous example of how rhyme enhances the power of the poem. I'm just curious, why do you feel that it is your best poem?
I think that it does use the resources of meter and rhyme in support of its ideas, and that it does so easily and with obvious pertinence. I think that if I wanted to see any poem of mine in the light of Robert Frost's statement, which you quoted just now, I think it might be Trismegistus. It gets a lot of emphasis and pertinent echo out of rhyming, and all that seems utterly natural.
Poet Richard Wilbur. Stay tuned for more of our conversation after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're spending the hour with the great American poet Richard Wilbur. Among his many honors is the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry, twice, and he was named Poet Laureate of the United States in 1987. Wilbur spoke with me and guest co-host Christian McEwen at his home in Cummington, Massachusetts, in June of this year.
Which poets do you yourself read for pleasure? Do you tend to go back to people, to the great ancestors like Milton, or whom among your contemporaries do you find yourself returning to?
Well, there are a good many of my contemporaries whom I read with pleasure. And when I say my contemporaries, of course, I'm speaking of a number of people who have died. But, for example, I never tire of reading Elizabeth Bishop. The precision of her eye, the quiet wit with which she writes. Elizabeth would be one of the poets I have known and read, to whom I happily return. I do return very often to John Milton, and that's not altogether surprising, because I found myself teaching him once again at Amherst last year. But I would go back to Milton whether I were teaching him or not. And I noticed that I don't spoil him for myself by talking about him to students.
You also have been instrumental in fostering the publication of some of others, great poets of our time, including Stanley Kunitz. And I think you were also a supporter of Donald Hall. Could you talk a bit about the connections that poets make with each other and the mutual support? It does seem that there's more of that in poetry than in other literary genres.
Well, there probably is, because even though there have been considerable changes in the poetry scene since I entered it, the poetry reading, for example, is now a fairly popular form of concert. And I think that when I was a kid, there were very few poetry readings to be had, even in university towns. And as for people barnstorming, the only barnstormers I can think of from those days were Robert Frost and Carl Sandburg sometimes, and of course Vachel Lindsay. They traveled the country giving successful performances, but it was, on the whole, an uncommon form of concert. One could talk also about the sales of poetry books, which have indeed increased. And a new volume of poetry, which is favorably reviewed, is likely to please the publisher by its number of sales.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with poet Richard Wilbur. I asked him to tell us what it was about Stanley Kunitz's work that had drawn Wilbur to support it in helping Kunitz gain a larger audience.
Stanley Kunitz was a very fine poet before I ever met him, and I had read him with pleasure from the treasured volumes of certain friends. He had his admirers, but it just happened that I was able to be useful to him. The first time I went to see him in New York City, Stanley was a little distressed because no publisher seemed to want to do the kind of new and selected that he had in mind. And I thought that was perfect nonsense on the part of these publishers. So I sent off a postcard at once to my friend Wendy Morrison, who was then an editor at Little Brown, and said, why don't you get in touch right away with Stanley Kunitz, ask him to send you a manuscript. If he does, you'll want to publish it, and it will win the Pulitzer Prize. And all of that happened. And I was delighted to be useful to Stanley in that way. And lots of poets have been useful to other poets, as you were saying. It is, I suppose, a competitive world, but it's a world in which many people rise above competition and are of use to each other.
Is there something about poetry that actually brings out the best in us?
Is there something that brings out the best? I'm not sure. I'm not sure that it brings out the best in us. I think I'd have to go off and ponder that question for a while.
I was thinking both as a reader as well as a poet. I mean, from the stance of the reader as well as the poet.
I think poetry does a lot of things for us. I have a little poem called A Barred Owl in which I say that that one thing poetry does is to teach us to say the names of what we dread, what we fear. Any kind of articulateness is emboldening to the human creature. And that's one job that poetry does, I think. As Thomas Hardy said, to have a look at the worst, to specify what is dreadful, is in some degree to disarm those things.
Do you have that poem at hand? Could you read that to us?
Yes. This is the poem we were speaking of. It's called A Barred Owl. And when I read this to an audience, I always remind them that a good many of them will already understand that what the barred owl says when it cries out in the woods at night is, "Who cooks for you?" A barred owl. The warping night air having brought the boom of an owl's voice into her darkened room. We tell the wakened child that all she heard was an odd question from a forest bird, asking of us, if rightly listened to, "Who cooks for you?" And then, "Who cooks for you?" Words which can make our terrors bravely clear can also thus domesticate a fear and send a small child back to sleep at night, not listening for the sound of stealthy flight, or dreaming of some small thing in a claw, borne up to some dark branch and eaten raw. There was a teacher in the Philadelphia area who told me that one of her students had said, "Oh, A Barred Owl, that's that poem which begins like a lullaby and ends like a nightmare." and it does. But I think, as I said, that one of the functions of poetry is to make our terrors clear and so disarm them a little. The worst thing of all is nameless dread, isn't it?
Yeah, and yet, ironically, what just came to mind was one of your poems of that I have read of greatest joy. I think it's probably one of your most well-known poems, with the laundry, the angels. What is the name of that poem again?
Well, it has a long name. Love calls us to the things of this world. I thought that I took that title directly out of the Confessions of St. Augustine. A number of fathers at Notre Dame have not been able to find it there verbatim. But actually, not long ago, I was looking into Augustine again, and that title is the gist of some things he is saying in the very earliest pages.
In the earliest pages of which?
Of his Confessions, yes.
So, would you read that poem for us?
Sure. Some poets get very tired of their most popular poems. And, I've heard that it was an agony for Mr. Yeats to have to read that poem about the Isle of Innisfree yet again. Though I can understand that in his case, because the Innisfree poem is not in the style to which he later came, I think. It may be a charming poem, but it's not the way he was being interesting in his latter years. Let's see if I can find that blasted poem.
Do you also feel weary when asked to read this poem?
I don't feel at all weary of this one because I like it, and I'd be happy to have written it yesterday. Sometimes I find it useful to the audience to, when I'm about to read this poem, to tell them that it was written in Rome. And perhaps it's a poem that refers to nuns at one point, and there are more nuns in the street in Rome than in Schenectady, for example. But also, I think that much of America had given up drying laundry in the air when urban Italy was still persisting in it. I don't know how it is right now. I don't know how many laundry lines you could expect to see looking at a Roman apartment house. But when I was there in 1956 or so, one woke up in our apartment house of a Monday morning, and our neighbor's laundry was being yanked across the window on a system of ropes and pulleys. Love calls us to the things of this world. The eyes open to a cry of pulleys, and spirited from sleep, the astounded soul hangs for a moment bodiless and simple as false dawn. Outside the open window, the morning air is all awash with angels. Some are in bedsheets, some are in blouses, some are in smocks, but truly there they are. Now they are rising together in calm swells of halcyon feeling, filling whatever they wear with the deep joy of their impersonal breathing. Now they are flying in place, conveying the terrible speed of their omnipresence, moving and staying like white water. And now of a sudden they swoon down into so rapt a quiet that nobody seems to be there. The soul shrinks from all that it is about to remember, from the punctual rape of every blessed day, and cries, "Oh, let there be nothing on earth but laundry, nothing but rosy hands in the rising steam and clear dances done in the sight of heaven. Yet, as the sun acknowledges with a warm look the world's hunks and colors, the soul descends once more in bitter love to accept the waking body, saying now in a changed voice as the man yawns and rises, "Bring them down from their ruddy gallows. Let there be clean linen for the backs of thieves. Let lovers go fresh and sweet to be undone, and the heaviest nuns walk in a pure floating of dark habits, keeping their difficult balance."
I just have to ask about a couple of words. And, you know, I feel awkward asking a poet about words because a poem is about, ironically so, because a poem is an entirety. It's a whole thing. But words are pivots. And there is a word that's a pivot in there that really struck me when I read that. And it was the word rape. It just comes so suddenly and it's like a turning. You wrote it a long time ago, but I wonder if you could, do you remember choosing that word and why that word?
Punctual rape of every blessed day. I suppose that if I had said the punctual violation of every blessed day, it would have seemed less jarring, though of course that's what I mean. Every day begins potentially blessed, and then we louse it up. I'm not sure that for me it's one of the obtrusively shocking words in the poem, but I think I've answered your question, haven't I?
Yes, you have. And then the other word that I actually just loved because it was so completely unexpected was hunk.
Hunk, yes. That word absolutely delights me in this poem. I wanted very much to have it there because at that point the poem is coming down off it. There's no more disembodied spirituality in it. It's coming down to come to terms with the material, the physical, and the everyday. And hunk does a lot of that in one word.
I have two little questions. I have a huge fondness for your poem, A Summer Morning, perhaps because I grew up in that rather old-fashioned ambiance myself. I grew up in Scotland in the country. And I wondered whether there was a particular story that gave rise to that poem.
A Summer Morning, that's about the young people coming home in the morning and bumping their fender against the gate.
The servants are in charge of the place because the young couple have not yet descended to their estate.
I don't think I knew any particular pair of dissolute young people when I was visiting in England. Of course, this scene could be in various parts of America as well. And I think this is a poem that drew in a general way on my experience, but did not have original persons in mind. I grew up on a place which we didn't own, in which there were gardeners everywhere, and so it didn't seem at all odd to me that there should be a gardener at the end of this poem. And when I was a kid, even though we were going through the Depression, everybody had servants. So I think that there's nothing specially odd in this poem, and certainly there's no particular story behind it. A Summer Morning. Her young employers, having got in late from seeing friends in town and scraped the right front fender on the gate, will not, the cook expects, be coming down. She makes a quiet breakfast for herself, The coffee pot is bright, the jelly where it should be on the shelf. She breaks an egg into the morning light, then, with the bread knife lifted, stands and hears the sweet, efficient sounds of thrush and catbird, where, in the terraced backward of the grounds, a gardener works before the heat of day. He straightens for a view of the big house ascending stony grey out of his bed's mosaic with the dew. His young employers having got in late, he and the cook alone receive the morning on their old estate, possessing what the owners can but own.
Thank you so much for reading that. I delight in its specificity and in that very precise joyousness that it celebrates. It's lovely how you've done that. So I had one last question. There's a couplet in yet another of your older poems, the one called At Year's End, which was written way back in 1949. Yes. And you speak there of men expecting yet another son to do the shapely thing they have not done. And I wondered for yourself, you have done so many shapely things. Do you feel that you have done what you came here to do, or are there yet more mountains that you see on the distance that you want to climb?
I don't think I think farther ahead than the next possible poem, but I should be very sorry if I didn't find that there was still some impetus, some inclination to write another poem. I don't know what I might next translate. That's been part of my general impetus, and of late I've been translating Corneille. I've published one of his plays, a wonderful thing called The Theatre of the Illusion, a couple of years ago, and I'm about to publish two more plays of his, Le Cid and The Liar. I don't know where I'm going from there. A friend tells me I'd better do Corneille's Nicomède, but I'm not really yet familiar with that play. Haven't been grabbed by it. Something will grab me. I'll probably want to do another translation. And it would be foolish, not for gloomy reasons, but it would be foolish in general to think beyond the next task. I hope for another poem, and I'd be pleased if some French text hooked me and made me translate it.
Well, Richard Wilbur, thank you so much for talking with us here in your lovely writing space.
You're very welcome.
As Christian and I made our way out with Wilbur, I noticed his hallway was lined with posters. One was of a painting by Andrew Wyeth with a poem by Wilbur beneath it. Tell us about this.
There was an outfit called Poetry on the Buses, I think, and I believe it was in Pittsburgh, and they wrote to me and said they were trying to get permission to reproduce something of Andrew Wyeth's, and they needed a little poem to go with it. And Wyeth had said, well, you may have it if Wilbur will do a poem. So I did this little poem.
And will you read it for us?
Beyond them, hill and field. Well, I should start with the title, Wyeth's Milk Cans. Beyond them, hill and field harden, and summer's easy wheel ruts lie congealed. What if these two bells tolled? They'd make the bark splintering music of pure cold.
That's great. Thanks, the two milk cans. Yeah. Just beyond the Wyeth poster, the wall was filled with playbills from the theater productions Wilbur had written the lyrics for. So this is a wall of your of your translations. We have Tartuffe. Yes,
mostly it is. I was also I was involved in a musical. I did the lyrics for a musical with Hellman and Bernstein back there.
And I heard that was, I mean, they were two pretty strong personalities.
Very strong personalities. Well, I loved Lillian's personality. We had a great time together. Bernstein and I were friends too, and but we had the inevitable squabbles that lyricists and composers have. But I was very admiring of him, and he was wonderfully full of energy. It was great to work with him.
And, I mean, this, just to read here, this is a poster. When was this, by the way?
I think it was 56.
So it's staged by the great Tyrone Guthrie, great, great director. These are names I remember from my childhood, actually.
Yes. Oh, he was a wonder, a very good director.
And Dorothy Parker, she also participated in the lyrics?
She's somewhat over-advertised here because she tried out, more or less, as a lyricist of the show, and then she didn't get along with Bernstein, and she quit. And there are just a few lines of hers left in the final version of the show. But her name was so famous, it seemed suitable to advertise in that manner.
It's about as big as Bernstein's. Well, that's wonderful. Thanks so much.
Well, great.
That was Richard Wilbur talking with Writer's Voice in 2009. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writers Voice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.